So in the middle of June 1909, Dayton, Ohio, the city was preparing for a celebration like they had never had before and quite frankly have never had since. It was a special occasion, as you can imagine. There was a homecoming, and two of Dayton's most well-known citizens were coming back from a tour of Europe. It was 1909. And brothers Orville and Wilbur Wright had conquered flight. They had been touring throughout Europe, demonstrating how their flying machine, after the Americans and the French and all sorts of other people had been trying to figure this out for decades, really. They finally mastered it in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. You guys know the license plates. But Orville and Wilbur were from Dayton, and they were proud of that, and Dayton was proud of that. So they had been throughout Europe demonstrating that. They're finally coming back stateside. They're coming back to their hometown, and the folks of Dayton, Ohio were ready to welcome their boys home. They were proud of their accomplishment. So they elected a planning committee to organize this great celebration. They sent engraved invitations to President Taft and all of his cabinet, all of the Supreme Court justices at the time. They prepped over 100,000 buttons to sale for people to wear at the parade. The parade itself extended some 2 miles on the day of the celebration, and it culminated in the center of Dayton, Ohio at Main Street. On either side of the street, they put these 80-foot pipes, and they shot 50-foot flames into the air. This was a big, big deal. Now, this is how we expect a homecoming to look, right? You've got somebody that's come from your city, from your town. They're kind of like you. They know some of the same folks that you know. You know some of them. They go out into the world and they make an impact. And because they're from your town, you're proud to know them. You're proud that they're from your place. And when they come home, you're excited. So you throw a party. You have a celebration. You welcome them with joy. And yet, as we just read there in Mark 6, as Jesus entered his hometown 2,000 years ago in a little city called Nazareth, the reception could not have been any more different, could it? There's no parade. There's no celebration. There are no buttons being sold. There are no 80-foot pipes shooting 50-foot flames into the air. It couldn't have been any more different at all. And the scene we just read about there, it's all the more remarkable when you consider what's been happening as Jesus has been out into the world, as he has traveled and taught in other places. So we've got just 6 verses to look at here. I'm just going to divide them evenly, 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, around three basic ideas. One is Mark's context, how the evangelist Mark, the guy who wrote this gospel, how he sets up the scene and helps us understand what's going on before and during this moment. Then we get the crowd's reaction in verses 3 and 4, and it's not exactly what we would anticipate for the homecoming of a native son. And then we're going to learn about Jesus' response, beginning in verse 4 through verse 6. So we think about Mark's context here. He tells us back in chapter 1, and you guys have been studying through Mark. I tried to study through Mark a little bit in preparation for coming here. Back in chapter 1, in verse 9, Mark tells us that Jesus came out of Nazareth, and then now he's been ministering throughout Galilee. His reputation has been growing. And you guys have seen this. You may remember back in chapter 1 when he's baptized, there's this heavenly proclamation, this voice from the clouds. This is my beloved son. And all who are present hear that. No doubt they go back and tell others about that. He begins traveling throughout Galilee. Mark summarizes it briefly. He's preaching in the synagogues. He's casting out demons. As you might imagine, his fame is spreading throughout the region. And then, as you learn about in chapter 3, like a lot of other well-known teachers in his day, he's even gathered disciples now. And they accompany him as he comes back into Nazareth. So what's it going to be like when he returns home, when he comes back to the place where he is from and he's gone out into the world and he's made an impact, he's made a name for himself, he's even had the opportunity to make a name for Nazareth? What's it going to be like when he comes home? Well, what we see is it's not at all like Dayton, Ohio in the summer of 1909. The people there receive him in a very different way. And it's not even like what we've seen most recently in Mark's gospel. I know recently you guys were looking at chapter 5. Personally, my favorite story in the gospel of Mark. There are those two miracles kind of intertwined and woven into one story. And at the center of both, there's the presence of faith. So Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue in Capernaum, he goes to Jesus because his daughter is sick, and he believes that Jesus can do something about it. Right? He has some sort of faith that Jesus is capable of changing the situation. And of course, on the way, there's an interruption. You guys know the story. The woman who has dealt with this long-term medical condition reaches out, grasps his garment, and Jesus commends her. He says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." So if you think about what you've seen in Mark, Jesus is not merely drawing a crowd at this point, but people are beginning to believe that maybe, just maybe, he really could be the long-awaited Messiah. And then chapter 6 comes, and he comes home, and the scene here stands in sharp contrast to that beginning of faith that we see there in chapter 5. It says in verse 1, he went away from there and he came to his hometown. So he went away from there, meaning Capernaum, Galilee, the other side of the sea, these places where he's been touring about and teaching and drawing a crowd, and he came to his hometown. I was thinking about that transition from going there and then coming home this week, and it reminded me of my first international trip, the first time I went overseas on a mission trip, actually. I took a group of college students to China. And so I grew up in Kentucky. I'm not a native South Carolinian. We've been here about 3 years. But I grew up in a little town in Kentucky, and it was not a diverse town. To put it bluntly, most people in my hometown looked a lot like me, right? And so when we left a different part of Kentucky, but we went to Nashville, Tennessee, we got on a flight. We flew down to Atlanta, Georgia, and of course, Atlanta's a larger city, a lot more diversity, but I began to notice the diversity began to kind of cluster around people who appeared to be of Asian descent the closer we got to our gate, right, as we were preparing for the international flight. So we board the flight in Atlanta, and there are, you know, people who look like they are probably native, or look like they're probably Americans. There are people who look like they are probably from Asia, possibly Chinese, but it's kind of mixed. It's a pretty diverse group as we fly across the ocean and land in Beijing. Then we got on a bus from the Beijing International Airport, went to the Beijing Domestic Airport, and I'm starting to feel more like I'm in China. Seeing fewer and fewer people who look like me, and for me, a guy who grew up in a very undiverse town, it was just a new experience. It was something I was kind of taking in and reflecting on. And then we got on a flight going from Beijing to this, you know, smaller city in China. China's cities are, they're smaller, like our metropolises, but the smaller city in China. And we got on the flight, and we were the only people who were obviously American. And it was just a very different experience, maybe 75 people on the plane, and it seems as if we're the only ones who speak English. And I remember thinking, what is this going to be like when we get to this place? We're going to stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, how are people going to receive us? What is this experience going to be like? I'd never really encountered something like this before. And so we landed in this city called Changsha. Then we got on a bus. This took like a day and a half. It was so long. We got on a bus, and then we went to a smaller Chinese city that most Americans have never heard of. Smaller, had about 6 million people. But in China, it was a small city. And we got to this place where it was very rare for them to have visitors from the West. And so as we began to walk around the city, and we did some ministry on a college campus, and we got to know some locals, we began to realize that for many of the people we were encountering, we were the first Americans they had ever met. And to just put it bluntly, we were the first white people they had ever seen. And so we were fascinating to them. I had two twins on my team. It was a team of college students. I had two twins with red hair. So these Chinese people that have never seen anyone that did not have dark hair, like typical Asian color, all of a sudden they see these two redheads walking down their street, and they're fascinated. But the Chinese are so welcoming. They're so hospitable. And we picked up early that they wanted to make sure that we Americans had a great experience in what they considered to be their small town, right? So we were treated like royalty. I mean, everywhere we went, we got the best table in the restaurant. When we checked into the hotel, they have to check our passports. The person behind the desk noticed that my birthday was that week. On my birthday, I came back to my room to a cake, a big cake in the room. I was a little afraid to eat it, but it was big, beautiful cake. They just did everything they could to welcome us and make us feel at home. When we would go on the college campus, the Chinese students would want to come up to us and practice their English. And so there were times, I'm not exaggerating this at all, when I would be kind of standing in a crowd and a group of Chinese students would gather around me just waiting for an opportunity to talk to me and say something very basic so that they could have the experience of having spoken English with a real American. Now, a week of that can get to your head. We began to think, we are a pretty big deal here in China. I felt like the Beatles coming to America. Like, these people have waited for us, and we are here. And so that was China. That was a tremendous experience. We stuck out like a sore thumb, but they treated us with such kindness and hospitality. And then we began to leave there and travel home. Got back on that bus, up to Changsha, back on a plane to Beijing again. We flew from Beijing to Chicago, and the flight's beginning to get more diverse again. We don't seem as important when there are other Caucasians on board. And as we're landing in America, we're starting to realize these people have not been waiting on us to return. And I'll never forget the experience of going through the baggage claim and everything, and we were all so hungry. We got in line at this Schlotsky's Deli, and the person behind the counter was so absolutely rude, just absolutely rude, obviously was not preparing for our visit, was not impressed that we were there, did not even want to talk to the twin redheads I'd brought along with me. She was just unimpressed that we were there all together. You see, we had left there, this place where we were unique and celebrated, and we had come home, and all of a sudden we weren't that big of a deal. I think that's some of what we see here in Mark's context, because Jesus has been out in Galilee, and he's been a big deal to some extent. Not everyone is believed. There's a lot of stuff going on, but people are following him. They're coming to him. He's having to withdraw to desolate places to get away from the crowds. And then he goes home, and we would expect a nice return. We would expect a big welcome. And instead, the reception is totally different. So you look in verses 3 and 4 there, and you start to see the crowd's reaction. How did the crowd respond to Jesus when he returns home to Nazareth? Well, Mark summarizes the reaction with 5 questions here. I think he's taking a larger episode, and he's condensing it down to a few things here. And it's interesting to pick apart those questions and try to figure out where exactly the crowd is in terms of their reception of Jesus. If you just looked at the first 3 questions, they seem a bit neutral. I mean, they could be genuine questions from a crowd of people who are astonished at this guy that has come into their town, or they could be kind of loaded questions from a crowd that's frustrated because this guy has come into their town and he's claiming the things that he is claiming. But as you read on and you get into verse 3, eventually Jesus' response in verse 4, you begin to see their questions, they get a bit more negative. It's a bit more obvious that they're maybe not receiving him as we might anticipate. So a couple different opinions on this. Maybe the crowd is sort of speaking as a whole and their opinion really does change, and Mark's trying to give us that progression in some sense because the first question is a bit more neutral and by the end it sounds a bit more offended. Maybe he's representing a mix of people. I think that's probably the most natural way to read it. There's a crowd of people in the synagogue, not unlike this morning. A new guy is in town, and probably everyone is having a slightly different opinion as to what they think about it. And so Mark tries to capture that in some way, and I think it's helpful to look at those questions one by one to just get a sense as to what the people were thinking as they're hearing Jesus teach here in the Nazarene synagogue. So that first question there, I believe it's at the end of verse 2, says, where did this man get these things? It's a natural question. They're wanting to know the source of his authority. And why should we believe him? Where did these things come from? Who sent him to us, right? Then that second question, what is the wisdom given to him? They want to know the scope of his teaching. And Mark doesn't give us much by way of the content of what Jesus said in this story. But if we were to flip over to Luke chapter 4, I think we'd find Luke's version of this same scene, the parallel story in Luke. And he actually focuses more on what Jesus said and less on how the crowd reacted. And we kind of pull those two things together. We get a little better picture of what was probably going on here this day. And so in Luke 4, we read that Jesus came into the synagogue in Nazareth, just like he had in other synagogues throughout Galilee. And they were reading from the prophet Isaiah. He came up to the front. This was kind of a typical traditional thing to invite an honored guest, a recognized teacher from the outside to come and teach a little, to read something from the scroll and then to exposit it or explain it in some way. And so Jesus gets the scroll, according to Luke, and he goes and he finds Isaiah 61. And he reads these words, which Luke records for us in chapter 4, 18 and 19. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. That's Isaiah 61, and every person in that room, I think, would have known that that passage is envisioning a day when this future Messiah, this one who will be anointed of God, who will bear the Spirit of God, would come into their midst and restore the people of God. And then guess what that guest teacher did? He leaned forward to the crowd and he said, "This is about me. This is fulfilled today in your presence." And so you can imagine these questions. Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How does he know he's the Lord's anointed? What is this good news he has come to proclaim? And it all seems to center around those words. Then that third question, they say, how are such mighty works done by his hands? They want to know not just the scope of his teaching, but also the secret to his miracles. And obviously, the reports of the things Jesus has done in Galilee have come over to Nazareth. Perhaps he's even done some miracles in their city already. Mark makes reference to that down in verse 5. But they want to know, how is this happening? What's his secret? And if I were in a room and people were asking these questions, I would start to gather at this point, if I were just an observer hearing people ask these questions. You tend to ask that when you're not so sure if you're believing it, right? You can almost feel the opinion of the crowd sort of drifting toward, we're not sure about this guy. How does he do such mighty works? And then it begins to get even more obviously negative, I think, when they say, is this not the carpenter? In verse 3. Is this not the carpenter? You start to call attention to his work. This blue-collar guy. And what they're essentially beginning to say is, wait a second. You can't be the guy that Isaiah 61 is talking about. We know you. You're a carpenter. You're just a regular guy. You're just a working man. You couldn't possibly be the one we have been waiting for. And then the last set of things there, I take as kind of one basic question about his family. I think it's sharpest in that first phrase where they say, is this not the son of Mary? And then they start to list his brothers and sisters and all of that. I think the point of all that, again, is we know this guy. We know his family. They are common people. Are we really to believe that he is the Lord's anointed, that the Spirit of God is upon him to set the captives free, to bring liberty to those who are in bondage? He's just a regular guy. Could he really be the one? regardless of how you take that particular statement, when they say he's the son of Mary, by the way, that could be a kind of not so veiled jab at his parentage, his lineage, right? He's the son of Mary, as in, we don't even know who the dad is, right? That's perhaps a rumor that was floating around Nazareth. It could be just as simple as Joseph has died at this point, and he's been dead long enough that they would call him the son of Mary instead of the son of Joseph, because Joseph hasn't been around for some time. We don't really know why, but it's odd they call him the son of Mary. It's almost certainly derogatory. That's not the way that you would refer to a Jewish man in that culture, as the son of his mother. And so they're starting to knock this guy down a bit with these questions. And so if you look at all that together, you see that there's not a celebration here. There's this kind of growing skepticism. And I think these questions represent a variety of reactions to Jesus. But to me and to us today, I think they demonstrate an important truth, and that's this. Unbelief is never generic. It's never just broadly generic. It's always tied to particular ideas. And often when a person rejects the truth, and this may be helpful for you if you're in the process now of trying to minister to a neighbor or a friend or a family member, and you just don't feel like they're believing the things you are saying, and you're trying to challenge them on certain points, and they seem to always have a ready answer to combat against you. Often when a person rejects the truth, they seem to have a number of reasons lurking beneath the surface. I don't think we do ourselves any favors by just calling it unbelief in general and not digging deeper to figure out what's really going on. And the key thing I want to point out as we think about these folks in Nazareth that day is that even skeptics hold their beliefs by faith. These skeptics believed something. And so part of our task as Christians is to help people sift through what they believe and then help them see how the gospel answers that. So the crowd at Nazareth here, I believe they are people of faith, just like the disciples. So the question is, what did they believe? I mean, what were they hoping in? What were they holding on to? Where were they placing their faith, right? We could say a lot of things. We obviously don't have a whole lot of data in that story in particular, but I think it comes down to essentially this. I think they were hoping in a Messiah who would come and rise above their circumstances, right? You think about the first century context here. In the first century Roman world, the Jews were a mostly forgotten people. That's easy for us to forget sometimes, because when we read our Bibles and we go back, it feels like the Israelites are center stage, and then you go through like a world civ class in high school or college, and they don't really talk about the Israelites a whole lot when you're in the first century and the first few centuries and the last few centuries BC and things like that. The Jews are mostly forgotten. They tend to be lower class in society. They're relatively unknown on the world stage. They have been in the past, right? As a people, they have had their day. They have known the heights of political power. They've known the joys of worldly fame and others coming to them with respect. But now they live under the burden of Roman rule. They feel like a captive people. And they look to verses like Isaiah 61 in this hope that someday a Messiah would come and set them free and bring liberty to those who are in bondage and under the rule of someone else. And as they're thinking through that, they're thinking that their Messiah has to be someone different. He's going to be someone who's going to come and lead them out. He's going to reestablish their kingdom. He's going to restore their honor as a nation. And now, who do they have standing before him, before them claiming to be the guy? A carpenter from their hometown. And they think, this guy cannot be the Messiah. You see, because they held certain beliefs about what the Messiah would be like and should be like, they rejected Jesus because he didn't fit their preconceptions. He didn't fit their categories. And I think others will do the same to us. And so we have to be ready to help others sift through those things. What's at the root of a person's unbelief? And how does the gospel answer that? It's ironic to me that we're looking at this passage the week before Christmas. Because if you think about the very miracle that we celebrate this week, we just sang about and confess together, that very miracle is really at the root of what they are rejecting here in this story in Mark chapter 6. I mean, at Christmas, we draw attention to the humanity of Jesus. We celebrate his great humility and coming to us as a child. We sing about the dark streets of the little town of Bethlehem and how the everlasting light shone there. And we think about how unfathomable it is that the one who made the world could come and be someone we could hold in our very hands. It's hard to buy that, right? Now, as Christians, as people who hope in those truths, we recognize that as good news, right? To put it in the language of Paul in 2 Corinthians 8, we recognize this, the incarnation, the coming of Jesus into the world. We recognize it as the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. And this is what Paul tells the Corinthians, that though he was rich, for our sake he became poor, that through his poverty we might become rich. And so for us, the willingness of the Son of God to empty himself and embrace the form of a servant is at the heart of the good news. But this didn't seem like good news to the people of Nazareth on that day. You see, it didn't fit their preconceptions about what a Messiah should be like. They were placing their faith in human power, and the Son of Mary seemed remarkably weak. They were hoping in someone who would be prestigious, who would restore their honor among the nations. And this humble carpenter seemed altogether unimportant. They were looking for someone who could rise above and transform their circumstances. And instead, Jesus came and entered into their very circumstances, even to the point of walking their streets and inhabiting their town. And so Mark tells us in verse 3, in summary, they took offense at him. He didn't fit their preconceived notions. He contradicted beliefs they held dear. And so for the most part, the crowd's response here in Mark 6 is rejection. The Messiah, Jesus, the native son has come home and his own people have rejected him in large part. Now, before we move on to consider how Jesus responded, I think it's worth thinking about one more thing as we're thinking about their response here. Do you ever think about, when you read these stories in the Gospels, about the things that people do not say? We place a lot of emphasis on the things they do say and what they do, obviously, for obvious reasons. But do you ever think about what they don't say? I mean, we just finished a study of the Gospel of Luke at our church in Columbia. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about the various ways in which people responded to Jesus. And one of the things I try to do is put myself in the shoes of those people. If I were in this town and this guy came into my village and began preaching these things and I didn't believe him, if I didn't buy what he was selling, what would I do? How would I respond? How would I try to disprove what he is doing? I mean, think about this scene. Here's a man claiming to be the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies. If you reject him and you want to put an end to his popularity, I mean, think about all the things you could have said and done in this very moment in this scene. I mean, if he is claiming that the Spirit of the Lord is upon him and that the kingdom is arriving in power through him, don't you think it would be wise to maybe point out some of his flaws? I mean, if he has grown up in your town, if you have known him well for years, don't you think you draw attention to those things? I mean, I know if I were to go to my hometown and begin to proclaim to be the Son of God, it wouldn't take my friends very long to discredit that story. I've left behind lots of evidence that that's not who I am. And they could very quickly pull it to the front and dismiss the whole thing. And yet, no one accuses Jesus of being a fraud based on his previous actions or pattern of life. Nobody in Nazareth brings that up. You know, if he's been teaching in synagogues throughout Galilee, where's the Jewish apologist who goes up after him, grabs the scroll, and says, no, you can't be the Messiah. Let's read on in Isaiah 61, let me disprove you. And where's the person who grabs the scroll and proves him wrong? Yet, we don't see anyone challenging Jesus on exegetical grounds. No one enters into that kind of argument with him. If he has a reputation for mighty works, this to me is the most obvious one, and you don't think he's doing those, how hard would it be to disprove them? I mean, if he's a huckster and he's fooling crowds across Galilee, expose him as a fraud. How hard could that be? I mean, these people in Nazareth in the first century were no different from us in the sense that when they didn't believe something, I'm sure they thought of these things. And yet, no one suggests that these miracles haven't happened. They actually want to know how they've happened, right? So why don't we see any of this? Why does no one bring up the sins of Jesus' youth? Why does no one point out the flaws in his teaching or expose the secrets behind his so-called miracles? Well, could it be that he didn't leave him that option? He had lived among them for decades, and the best they have is, wait, aren't you the son of Mary? Aren't you just a carpenter? It feels like they should have better material. I hesitate to share an illustration from the world of politics, but I promise this is bipartisan. You guys, you'll have to imagine a hypothetical campaign that gets kind of heated, right? Maybe you've seen those before. We know when a campaign gets heated, the candidates are faced with this sort of decision often of, will I stick to the issues or will I go negative and attack my opponent's character, right? And again, maybe you've seen such a thing happen before. Sometimes, this is kind of a fascinating thing to me, like as these stories come out about one candidate and it looks pretty negative, the other candidate always has a tough decision to make. Have you ever noticed some of the commentary on that? They actually have to decide, am I going to go after this person based on their character flaws, or am I going to stick to the issues and show why I would be the better candidate? And there's a whole philosophy of thought that says you shouldn't attack the opponent, you should just stick to the issues, because as soon as you go after the person, as soon as you attack their character, as soon as you go negative and start punching below the belt, people are going to look upon you and realize you don't have anything else to offer. Your best reason for me to vote for you is that you're not as bad as that person, right? And so candidates will have to decide sometimes, is it worth going negative? Is it worth bringing up these things? As I read Mark 6 and I hear those questions, it feels like the best argument the crowd can muster up, it just sounds like a weak campaign ad. I mean, this can't be your Messiah. He's the son of Mary. He's a carpenter from Nazareth. I just think of all the things they could have said that would have easily convinced me that this is not the guy. And yet none of those things are spoken. I find it fascinating, and it makes you wonder if perhaps they had nowhere else to turn. If perhaps seeing this man whom they had watched for decades, the best they could do is point to his family, point to his job, and say, no, he just doesn't seem like the right kind of guy. So nonetheless, now we want to turn from how they responded, from their rejection to how Jesus responded. As we look at those final verses, probably the most famous statement in the passage is in verse 4, where Jesus says a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown. Jesus didn't write that. That's a pretty common saying in Jewish and Greek literature at the time. And it really shouldn't surprise us. Whenever I read this, I always think of my own attempts to minister to my own family. This is the holiday season. Some of you guys maybe in the next couple weeks will be traveling to visit family. Some of you will be hosting family. If you're a Christian, you have the opportunity in these moments to speak the grace of the gospel to people you no doubt love and cherish or at minimum are related to. And you have the opportunity to minister to them in a unique way in this season. And some of you may even now be getting a little nervous thinking about it. We've certainly had those kinds of interactions in our family. Sometimes the people you know best are the hardest people to interact with. And that seems to be what Jesus encounters here in his hometown. And the thing that is interesting is that this rejection seems to limit his ministry. There's a really curious phrase there in verse 5. It says, and Jesus could do no mighty work there. What in the world does that mean? Jesus could do no mighty work there. Well, it's tempting to interpret it as if the healing ministry of Jesus is somehow fueled by faith, and that fuel is lacking in this town. So Jesus is somehow prohibited from doing the work that he would like to do, if he could, right? We could think about how interpreting it in that way might even encourage us toward more faith, right? If you're praying for something, maybe you're praying for someone to be healed, maybe you're praying for God to do a great work, the more faith you have, the more likely it is for God to answer your prayer. And we could probably even find some verses in the Bible, you'll encounter one in Mark 11 in a few months, I don't doubt, that would even seem to support that kind of thinking. But I'll just be honest with you, I find that to be a real misinterpretation of what's going on here and a really dangerous line of thinking. If we begin to think that God is in some way limited by our lack of faith. So what are we to make of this? I mean, it says clearly he could do no mighty work there. So what does this mean? Well, I think, first of all, it's helpful to note that there are plenty of examples in the Gospels where Jesus does a miraculous work despite the absence of faith. In fact, the last chapter ended with one. All right, Jairus went to get Jesus to heal his daughter because she was sick. And then, of course, as you guys know, she died as he was journeying there. Jesus enters the home where a girl is dead on her bed, and he tells the people, "Don't worry, she's only sleeping. I've come to rise her." And they laugh, right? Hardly the marker of faith. And yet Jesus is not in any way hindered by their unbelief in that moment. Even in Nazareth, at the end of verse 5 there, it mentions that he did lay hands on a few sick people and healed them. And I guarantee to those people who were sick, those works felt pretty mighty to them, right? As I look around this room and I see especially several men whom I know are married and have lots of children, and I recognize none of them are here, I bet you'd be happy to have some healing hands laid on your family this morning to bring some healing, right? So we have to be careful that we don't measure the work of the Lord by our own standards, right? As if God doesn't answer this prayer in exactly the way I'm anticipating he will, then it's not going to count in some way. Yet there is a sense to which their lack of faith did lead to fewer mighty works. I think it's important to acknowledge that. And I would just frame it like this. I think for Jesus, it would not have been appropriate for him to do many mighty works in this town before these people, because to put it bluntly, they would not have appreciated it. You see, the miracles of Jesus were not cheap party tricks. They were not something Jesus brought along to just entertain people and draw a crowd. You guys have read about this in Mark 1. They were demonstrations of the power of the kingdom of God coming into their midst. And access to that kingdom, as you read about in Mark 1, is through repenting and believing. And so it would have been appropriate for Jesus to do great works here because the people would not have appreciated it. And yet Jesus does heal a few people, and it reminds us that God's purposes are far more complex than we often realize, and we ought to be very careful not to oversimplify them. So, wrapping up here, we see in Jesus' hometown, he's met with rejection instead of fanfare. He's met with unbelief instead of hope. And he's met with ridicule instead of rejoicing. And even Jesus himself marvels at the irony as he comes home and gets this kind of response. And I think there are at least three things that we can take away from this scene this morning. The first thing is that we ought to be encouraged as we see our Lord rejected here. If you're a Christian, you bear the call of God to go into your world and proclaim the grace that you have known. And you're going to find many people that shrug their shoulders and shake their heads. And in those moments, I think we can be comforted by being reminded that Jesus himself was rejected. That as he told his disciples, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And so one thing we learn here is that we can be encouraged when we face challenges in our own ministry. The second thing is this, that God has his purposes for even such difficulties. The Wright brothers, those sons of Dayton we talked about at the beginning, they were not known to be men of many words, but they had a knack for a good line. And so during one of those parades, they had this thing set up where everybody in the town actually went through and shook their hands. The guys got so tired at the end, they asked the people, would you mind if we just nodded our heads? And so they were just nodding their heads, and everybody took turns being nodded at by the Wright brothers. But one man came up to him, and he said, you know, it's so great that you guys figured out that flying machines needed both power and resistance in order to stay in the air. That was kind of like the key scientific discovery that helped them figure out flight. And Wilbur Wright said this. He said, yes, in aeronautics, we must have something to push against or we cannot go up. And in the game of life, it is the same way. See, Jesus, he didn't need something to push against in order to go up. He certainly didn't need the resistance of this crowd to accomplish the work that God the Father had sent him into the world to do. But it's a good reminder to us that even the crowds here served a purpose in the plan of God. They provided a contrast with the people who were beginning to believe. I think they helped make clear to us the necessity of repentance and belief. And in their own way, they remind us that Jesus' true homecoming is still to come. And I think that's the third thing we can take away from this story, is perhaps the reason Jesus was not welcomed and celebrated as he returned home to Nazareth is because in one sense, this wasn't really his home at all. And you see, and the scriptures tell us, guys, that someday there will be a celebration like the world has never seen before. I don't know if there will be 80-foot pipes and 50-foot flames, but the Lord promises us it will not disappoint. And on that day, Jesus will not be rejected. He will be celebrated as king. But here's the thing that we get out of this story. Because he was rejected on that day, in that time in Nazareth, you and I get to be invited to that celebration.